Hey, good evening. This is Jim Hoffman.
And this is Josh Knapp.
And we are here again at EMS Office Hours. And I want to thank you for listening live, of course, to the show and encourage you to take part in the conversation in the chat room. You can even call in toll free if you'd like. And the call number is 877-217-3924. If you listen to recorded version, I appreciate you taking the time to listen to this recording. And don't forget, you can find us as well at the ProBand Network, iTunes, and also on the emfofficehours.com blog. So this episode, Josh, I'm trying to do at least once a month, like I said last month, of kind of collecting a few topics that I see floating around there in blogs and in some of the popular EMS websites, on Facebook, stuff like that, that I see a lot of interaction. I see a lot of people with passion for the topics that I'm kind of selecting and hoping maybe to give a voice to it from you and our, you know, your or mine little discussion here, maybe somebody that calls in or people in the chat room and things like that, to kind of maybe bring it a little another step further. Maybe clarify some things for people if people have questions on things, and
or just get it on the front burner.
Right.
I mean, you know,
exactly.
I was watching. excuse me. Hold on. I had to clear my voice. I was watching a thing on was a 60-minute repeat on how Facebook has changed the world, and they, of course, are focusing on the revolutions in the Middle East and the Arab Spring. And how communications through Twitter and Facebook have allowed people who want to protest and are basically silenced for their protests a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of, and I don't want to say anything. I mean, it struck a nerve, but it was in a long. You know, we get into these conversations of EMS having a voice, having getting together and speaking in a way that we are heard. And, you know, you look around Facebook, and there are some pretty big groups out there.
Sure.
And very involved membership. I mean, it, you know, you get some pages now and then that are kind of stale, and the posts stay up there for months at a time.
Yeah.
But you get stuff that's changing by the minute on a lot of these sites. And it's it's encouraging to see. I got to tell you.
One thing that I saw, and this is funny because I visit Tim Noonan's website, Rogue Medic, quite often, and he actually had a posting on there about arming of EMS. And I'm reading it, and I happen to see your name because that post that he made was kind of based
– aren't I?
Well, it was kind of based on you know, like a question. I see sometimes on your Facebook page you kind of post like a question to people. You know, what would they do or how they do things on their rig or in their agency, things like that. And it tends to get the conversation going with people on some of the questions that you pose. You know, you get a lot of likes there, a lot of comments, which is great. And I thought that – and that actually, again, motivated him to kind of, I guess, put his own little spin on it. And he mentioned why we're so afraid of our patients, and it was based on your post on Facebook about whether or not EMS should be armed, if people out there have been assaulted or not assaulted. And I'm just wondering, what motivated you for that post? Was it just a question you were posing, or something?
You know what? I got to tell you, not much surprises me, and I was surprised by the. By the response, by the passion of the responses and how quick, you know.
Right.
I was coming across something and about people – hold on for a second here. Hold on for one.
All right, we're losing them. So if you're in the chat room, if you've ever been assaulted or anything in EMS, be sure to put it in the chat room so we can, you know, maybe bring that in here.
Sorry, my dog was starting to act up. Basically, it was, you know, there was a situation. I was working 911, and we had a person, and they were an EDP. And the individuals that they were with were saying that this person was very dangerous and such, and we had called the police. And a couple of weeks later, I saw this posting on another page on on Facebook, and it's a fairly active site. I think it was EMS paramedics or the most interesting ambulance in a crew in the world or whatever.
Yeah, I've
you
seen
know,
that page,
they're,
yeah.
And they're good posts. I'm not putting
sure.
these guys down. But they put up a post that was like, the guy went in and he used the voice of command, and he said, "We're not going to have any problems here, are we?" And he threw on the lights in the room, and the guy, all of a sudden, he's all scared, and he's like, "Oh, no, sir, no, we're not." And he says, "Okay," and just sort of marches him through. And, you know, Jim, I was an auxiliary officer for the Parks Department, and we learned verbal judo. And there's an aspect where, yes, you can take charge, you can take command, and you can, you know, use your voice, use your intelligence, use your skills, and make sure that, you know, the patient goes along with you. But keep in mind, we deal with people who, you know, EDPs, and in the New York or the East Coast, we call EDPs sometimes psych patients, elsewhere, emotionally disturbed patients, emotionally disturbed persons. They're called that way, they're classified that way for a reason, because they won't always act in a predictable manner.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I saw that post and there was a couple of hundred hits on his, and I said, well, you know, what's the next step in that? And I was thinking, well, you know, there are always these guys who are I mean, almost everybody I know in EMS carries a knife, but for utility purposes.
Yeah.
And then I said, well, let's take that to the next level. And so I cut and pasted a picture of assorted arms and armaments, mostly knives and daggers. I put it up there, and I said, should we be armed? And in like 10 minutes, I got 30 responses.
Hmm.
And
no,
they
John,
ranged.
Go ahead. I got somebody on hold, I think, for this talk. I think it might be actually Tim.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
That's going to maybe hopefully give us his take on it. Tim, is that you?
Yep.
Hello.
Hey, Tim.
Hello.
Yeah, how you doing, Tim? We got Tim Noonan in the Rogue Medic online with us. Tim, I know you commented on a little bit on what Josh's post was, and Josh, I know you mentioned EDP. You know, my thing with that is I always say we shouldn't be going into EDPs until the scene is secure, and I don't think that's the type of call that necessarily I would be concerned with. I think it's more the unexpected type.
Well, I agree with that, and before just before Tim gets started, because I know he has a lot of thoughts on this, I thought the title of his post would just hit it right on the head. Why are we so afraid of our patients? I mean, you know, there's a point when we have to use our logic, use our understanding, and get involved into a situation. You're not going to run into a burning building. You know, why are you going to run into a situation where you know the person's unstable? Or if you discover the person's unstable, why are you going to stay in that situation?
Right. But, Tim, what are your thoughts on it, Tim?
I agree. I was disappointed in the comments that I saw in response to Josh's posting, and that was part of why I wrote this. I had written something similar about the Standing Orders podcast that was a month or two earlier on the same topic. And there are a lot of people who do not feel safe unless they are armed.
Hmm.
Yeah, I don't see it. Where are all these medics, EMTs, first responders being shot, stabbed, legend, whatever? You hear about a lot more of it in England, whether that's because of more reporting or, you know, something else, I don't know. But
do you think there's a lack of reporting in
how
the
many
US,
medics are murdered?
Yeah, right.
I think that a lot of stuff doesn't get reported.
Tim, did you try to do any research on that? Because I know you're great on finding details. I mean,
I know that there are occasional murders. I remember there was a discussion on one of the EMS email lists about 10 years ago on this, and people were criticizing me because I don't want to wear body armor. I mean, do not like body armor. I am going to sweat, and I'm going to be exhausted by the end of the day. I'm going to have to be downing lots of water just to keep up with what I'm sweating off. Body armor is uncomfortable. It's not that light, and, you know, it's just one more thing to aggravate you.
Well, let me play the devil's advocate on that for a sec. I mean, but it will protect you in a situation that could be unpredictable. It might let you go home that day. I mean, why not wear something
true,
where you can, you know, safeguard yourself?
But,
keep in mind, I'm playing devil's advocate on that because I have also – I have
yes.
body armor, but I don't wear it.
It only works against – certain specific things. In a crash, if your chest hits something, it may help protect you against that. But somebody pulls a knife on you, do not expect the body armor, unless you have a ceramic plate or a metal plate in it, to protect you against the knife. And it will only protect you if you get stabbed in the plate. If you get shot, again, only if you're shot in the vest. A lot of people know to shoot around the vest, and they'll aim for one center mass and just go with the recoil, and the second shot should be above the vest. Now, most people aren't very good shots, which is one of the advantages. You know, look at all the patients we treat who were shot. How many of them are shot in the legs versus the upper body? I would say probably 70% or more are just shot in the legs.
I think we are also dealing with a cultural, and if I could call it a cultural nuance or inflection, in terms of how we view gun ownership in the States. I mean, there are a lot of areas, like in New York City, for example, that, you know, just the possession of a gun is going to get you prison time. And, you know, a couple of well-publicized events of people who had legal ownership in another state came in not realizing that they had their weapon with them, and they got arrested for it. And now there's a big to-do whether or not they should drop the charges because they were legal. But I think that if you move west, you know, or west of New York, which is pretty easy to do, you'll find a real difference in opinion on gun ownership and the right to bear arms. But we're talking about, and I think some people in the posting that I put up confused the two. You know, I wasn't talking about the right to bear arms. I was talking about when you're on the job, do you feel that there's a need for you to carry a weapon? And,
yeah, well, what you do on the job, you know, and what you have a right to do are very different. You have a right to
right.
consume alcohol, but you shouldn't be consuming alcohol on the job. You have a right to carry a weapon, but you should either be leaving it in a locker or in your car or at home before your shift. How many employers trust their employees to fire a gun safely? And if you go into projects, which are the places that most people would be feeling afraid of being assaulted, and you fire a gun in the projects, almost always you've got other people on other sides of the walls there. What kind of ammunition are you using so it doesn't keep going when it hits the wall? Are you willing to take responsibility for hitting a child, an older person, or a cop in the next apartment?
Well,
you have no idea what's
your
going
on
in the next apartment.
How about your partner? You know?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
I know some people I would not trust with a gun, and I feel safest standing in front of them if they have a gun.
Now, guys, I mean, what do you
and
think?
We
I don't
have
think
no...
we should be carrying, though, right? I mean, it's...
I agree.
We kind of get
that.
Away from the medical part of it.
Well, I think the people who should be carrying are the police,
right.
Medics who are part of a tactical squad,
sure.
Something like that. We need to recognize when there is a problem. We need to be able to assess what's going on and say, hey, this scene is not safe. Yeah, we've
Right.
got the occasional politician who'll make a big deal about, oh, they didn't go into this shooting scene. There's something wrong with them. They have to accept the risks of the job. Like, no, you do not. These are usually people who are firearms opponents. You know, if they want us to go into shooting scenes, we should be armed, but we shouldn't be going into shooting scenes. That's where we need the police. And usually these are places where they don't have enough police. So you have two different problems. If there aren't enough police to escort EMS in, they need to get more police. I mean, it's not the solution is not to give lesser trained people more firearms, but to get the right number of police to be able to deal with the number of calls.
Yeah, and I don't think that it's a matter of escorting in. You don't get escorted into a dangerous situation. The police go in to secure the situation, to make sure that there are no active firearms or no shooting. You don't go, you know, we don't run in under fire unless it's a tactical situation. And the truth is I know and I work with
mm-hmm.
some of NYPD's tactical medics, and they carry firearms because they're police officers, but when they're in the role of medic, their firearms are basically holstered or slung back because they're doing patient care. So their focus is on, you know, accessing the person's blowout pack or accessing their own and or accessing their trauma pack and doing field medicine to stabilize the patient and get them out. And field medicine in a trauma situation, in a under fire situation, and I've taken a couple of courses involved in this, is basically stopping a major hemorrhaging. And,
mm-hmm.
and maybe securing an airway in terms of head positioning, and then getting that person out. There's not a you know, we don't start line, we don't start IVs, we don't start we don't do advanced airway maneuvers. We basically pull the person out of that situation, stabilizing them to the point, and what they're doing in Afghanistan, stabilizing them to the point so they don't bleed out in the field,
mm-hmm.
and then pulling them out. But there's very little of that idea of, you know, all of a sudden you're going to put the tourniquet down and pick up a sidearm and start shooting with the other guys who are shooting. You shouldn't be even in that situation where they're shooting in the first place.
So I think
but you can't always prevent it. I mean,
well, then, and therein lies
where
we
found
are.
Out later. Yeah, I found out later that yeah, I don't want to be here, and I've had people point.
Okay,
go ahead.
So where about having a weapon for defensive situation?
Oh well. The problems I've had, somebody points a gun at me, turn around, I walk out, and, you know, go back to the truck, call for police backup, tell them what's going on. Police go in, straighten it out. Either we're canceled from the call, or we go in to treat whoever is there who actually needs treatment after the scene is secure. Police are not always going to have the scene completely secure. I was on a scene with ESU, and a guy pulled out a knife. He was pulling it out just to hand it over because somebody was asking about weapons. And I was as close to him as one of the ESU officers. Next thing I know, one of them is standing in between this guy and me. And I felt very safe because this guy's huge. Plus, he's got all the body armor on. The knife is not going through him. I've had another scene where a guy was disagreeable. You know, he wasn't really trying to hurt anybody, but I ended up with a cop hiding behind me. That should not happen.
Yeah. Now, I think the main thing when we talk about arming ourselves, or I think the main thing is to try to make sure we're not putting ourselves in these situations to begin with, and that's the trying of I think kind of thing we should be focusing more on is getting the training to avoid getting ourselves in these situations to begin with. I do have one call on the line. I just want to bring them in and maybe get their take real quick before we get on to the new. Another subject for tonight, if you guys don't mind, just to see if we can bring them in here. Hi, Paula, who's this? Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, hi, who's this?
Hey, this is Randy.
Hey, Randy, how you doing?
Good, how are y'all tonight?
All
We're
right, all
doing
right.
good.
Any comments on what we talked about?
Well, my standpoint on this, I work down in Texas in a fairly large metropolitan area. And I heard a comment earlier about, most people that carry sidearms or use them don't fire very well. I read the post. I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name earlier. That posted the picture with all the knives and daggers. Who was that again?
That was me. That was Josh.
Okay, Josh. I read your article, and I actually commented on that the other day.
Oh, no,
and,
the article
I,
was Tim. Just sorry
was
to
Tim?
Confuse.
Okay.
I copied the picture that he posted on Facebook and used that as.
Okay, great. I agree. I read a lot of the comments on that, and it was very frightening. And my standpoint is, if we ever cross the line to where we're armed and carrying sidearms in the field, where are we going to get the governing to prove or to cover the training that people are going to need to do this? I have 8 years of tactical experience with SWAT teams in the Dallas area, and of course I had to qualify with a weapon, carry it, but that required me doing hours every week on the firing range. Where are the departments going to come up with the money to govern that?
Yeah, they can't afford
and I don't
stretchers
know what...
now. They can't afford getting stretchers and the latest life packs.
Exactly.
As far as that, yeah, exactly.
Right, and you've got to do hours of scenario training, and that's complex. That's not straightforward. Just even going to the range stuff, you have to go and work out, problematic situations
in
advance.
And then again, what about the things like psychological evaluations and stuff like that to carry, firearms and making those split second decisions on using it or not using it? And like, I think somebody mentioned earlier about, I've had partners I would not trust with a weapon of any type.
Very well said.
Well, the psychological evaluation for EMS is if you have failed the exam to become a police officer, you're fully qualified to work in EMS.
Right, right. And, I'm at my 17th year now, and I can really honestly think of very few situations where I ever felt that it would have even been remotely necessary to have a sidearm. And most of the time you're able to walk to clear the scene and get out before it came to that. So I just
right.
I'm afraid that if we did come to this, that we would start seeing a lot of what's the best way to say it? Snap decisions gone horribly wrong.
Well, there was on the chat room here, somebody was saying that, many police are shot with their own service weapons. And I'm sure that is, of police shootings, that does take up a certain percentage. And, we're focusing on firearms. And firearms are a very offensive weapon. They're not really a defensive weapon. You shoot in return of volley. You don't usually, in the offensive sense. And that's really not – that's really just sort of to ward off other shooting. If somebody stops shooting at you because you have a gun, then it's done its defensive it's done its defensive service. But what about – now, I work in an area, of course, where guns are not allowed. But like I was saying to Jim earlier, almost everybody I know carries a knife. And quote-unquote, that knife is for utility purposes. But, whenever somebody gets talking about weapons or something, they're always first to pull out those frickin' knives. And, I've worked with guys who also carry asps or collapsible batons. What's your feeling on those sort of quasi-offensive defensive weapons, although a knife is more offensive?
Well, when I look at a knife, I mean, all of us have been in EMS, have been involved with people in knife fights, dealing with people in knife fights, right? Have you ever seen either party come out and not cut the ribbons?
Yeah, there's usually a bloody mess.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to run the risk of pulling a knife out And unless you really know how to use it, you're going to run the risk of harming yourself just as much as you do your attacker. On my comment the other day on the Facebook post, the thing I put was, if anything at all, why not use tasers? Now, no, that's still one of those things that's in a gray area. Are they safe or not? Or
well, I mean, somebody followed that up.
But there's still a lot of fear.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And that's sort of two things, Tim. I mean, one is, yeah, why are we so afraid of our patients? And that's an excellent statement, and I reinforce that. But there's another aspect of wanting to be prepared, and I think that is the core essence of what we are in EMS. We go into a situation, we want to be prepared. If that person is on a medical call, we want to have all the right drugs with us. That's why we go through our packs and make sure that we have all the things to deliver those drugs. But, you know, sometimes we end up in what could be potentially or are violent situations, and there's that desire to be prepared for that. And instead, what we're trained is to sort of turn tail and get the hell out. Now, is that always a possibility,
prepared,
or sometimes you have to stand and defend yourself?
By prepared, what are we going to do? We are supposed to be prepared to intubate patients, but most medics intubate maybe once a year on average. That's not a lot. In between, how much do we practice intubating to maintain our skills? If we have to then add some other training that we need to do, who's going to pay for the training? Who's going to take the time to train? Maybe some people will spend a lot more time with a firearm or with a knife practicing, but I've noticed that even the people who are very eager to intubate will get maybe half a dozen tubes, and then they're no longer interested in practicing. They think, I've got it. I don't need to practice anymore. Next time, it's going to be automatic. And then
that's what the
next time,
you're
bailing them out.
And we've covered that. I mean, that's sort of we've covered that. I mean, in previous casts, where that's really what the system supports.
But it's the same problem.
And it's exemplified because now you have something that you can hurt multiple people very easily, or even hurt yourself. I mean, you're not really going to hurt yourself tubing a patient.
Usually
you're not going to accidentally shut down your own airway. And if you do,
but
maybe
we're,
that's Darwin.
You're really bad at it. You're really bad at it at that point. That point should be anywhere near it.
We're
that's
adding to the number of things that we should be training on and that we probably aren't training on. And rather than increasing the amount of training we're doing on the limited number of things that may improve outcomes, we're looking for more things where we need more training, and we're not going to get the training. Maybe we'll substitute firearms training for things that matter. How many medics really know their medications? How many are not going to make medication dosing errors? One of the things that happened where I work is because of the morphine shortage, we're switching from 10-milligram syringes to 15-milligram syringes. So instead of each line being 1 milligram, it's 1.5 milligrams. So it's something that we have to pay attention to when we're giving it. And the syringes look different, so it should be a reminder for everybody. And the people I work with seem to understand what they're doing, so I'm not afraid of them making drug dosage errors. But you keep reading about people making these errors.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, Tim, and I think we talked a little bit about this tonight even, about how all this type of thing, we talk about arming, you know, providers, there is an increased cost in training and equipment and all that, and instead of focusing on things that we should be focusing on as far as training and equipment, we start trying to go off onto other things that don't really benefit us in the long run, or most important, don't benefit them, but the mass majority of the patients that we encounter.
Well, I'm going to tell you, Jim, I think that where we're faced here is that nature abhors a vacuum. And in the absence of that training, in the absence of that direction, in the absence of the equipping of either the proper training to avoid those confrontational situations where you can get yourself in, or even in some cases where people feel very strongly that EMS should be equipped and weaponized, you're not going to have the money, as pointed out before, to do that training. And so because you don't have the money to do that training, we're still put out in the field with, you know, our brains and a little bit of equipment, and hopefully that equipment works. What do we usually do to supplement that? And, you know, there's a big aftermarket for everything from stethoscopes and shears down to tactical flashlights and even some weapons for first responders to carry with them that the organizations they work for don't supply them with.
And a lot of organizations, from what I know, everybody I've ever worked, they don't want you carrying knives. They don't want you carrying batons and stuff like that because it's a liability. If you use it on somebody, the agency, the organization – can get, you know, be sued for that, and they can be held liable for letting their staff carry these things without being properly trained. I mean, a classical baton, you know, there's still a level of training that should be provided on the use of that, not just buying it, you know, over the counter and then sticking it in your belt and whipping it out and swinging it around. I mean, there's a certain way to use those things, and police officers are trained on how to use that equipment, whereas, you know, people in the EMS just not trained for that.
How many times have you seen a guy with a collapsible baton, Jim, hit himself in the knee?
I had a partner that carried one all the time, and I was like, listen, what are you going to do with that thing? Just go, you know, go poke the bush over there and see if anything's behind it. That was pretty much the extent of using it, you know? I don't know.
But and I think we forget that the most dangerous weapon that we carry is usually our pen. You know, keeping that away from somebody who's violent. You don't hand it to somebody to get a signature because they're a violent, crazy person. You know, that's just asking to be attacked. You may have had somebody who is behaving themselves and cooperating, but now you put something sharp in their hand and you've given them ideas.
Yeah.
I'm more worried about a pen than anything else.
And Brian and Jared mentioned baton wouldn't work, you know, in the back of the ambulance. You're not going to have a lot of swimming room back there, you know, that you have an issue with. I mean, hopefully by the time they get in the back of the ambulance, they've already been identified if they're going to have any kind of weapon on them or whatever. If somebody with a baton is not armed at all and just on your stretcher and not behaving, it's going to go over well.
And that's the
but you also have size differences. Some of us are big enough that it's not a problem to control patients because, you know, we've got a size advantage on them. But there are plenty of people in EMS where the size disadvantage is the problem. They may be 100 pounds, 110 pounds, and the patient's 200, 300 pounds.
Right.
You get in the back of the ambulance, and they don't really need a weapon to be able to do some serious harm. But that doesn't get better by putting a handgun or a knife in the hands of the smaller person.
Yeah.
It just makes things a lot crazier. Because,
Randy,
if I'm driving, do I want my partner firing off rounds?
Only out the tech window. Randy, you were saying something?
Oh, well, I was just saying, you know, we're discussing the back of the ambulance, that's also a giant disadvantage where you have a firearm involved. It's a very small space back there. If you look at the average ambulance construction, we don't have a lot of square footage in the back of that truck. How hard is it going to be to draw your firearm, get an accurate aim point, and be able to pull the trigger without getting a stray shot going into the front of the cab or anywhere else in the back?
So let me ask the loaded question here, no pun intended. But what weapon, if we were going to arm EMS or we were going to equip EMS with something, you know, officially with training, what would be that appropriate device? Is it, you know, a taser? Is it brass knuckles? Is it, you know, a club? Is it
brain.
A knife? The brain. Yeah.
Like I said before,
the trouble is we can't always arm them with that, Jim.
But I think I honestly think that training and being aware of your surroundings at all times and thinking about the calls you're going into is going to prevent you from getting into these situations. I mean, I've been doing this over 20 years, and I've never gotten myself into a situation where somebody was going to have a gun or a knife. And I've been places where I've gotten to the scene, and I find out there's a gun that's still behind the door, and I don't knock on the door. I don't even take a chance. I wait. I'll call for police waiting to get there. You know, I mean, I had my episodes of, you know, wrestling with patients, and patients that might get a little confrontational, a little violent, and wrestling around with them. But when it comes to weapons or something like that, I don't take a chance, and I'm always trying to maintain my surroundings. And I think a lot of people kind of get caught up in the fact that, well, I'm in EMS and I've got some type of perceived authority that I don't really have, and I don't really have that training to deal with people that might pull a weapon on me. And that could be a chair, it could be a knife, whatever it is.
Yeah, I know somebody who had a bag of bleach thrown at him. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to step on you. Go ahead.
No, okay. Luckily, where I'm at, you know, discussing having police, where I'm at, where our officers can hear our traffic, and we respond along with our fire department here. And we have a very close-knit community here in our public safety, our EMS, fire, and police. So if they hear us going to an area of town that, not even an address, it's a history of problems, but just an area of town that we have a tendency to get hinky with, the police come with us without being called. So we're very fortunate in that. And you talk about not getting yourself into problems. The situation we have here in Texas, I'm not sure where everyone's from, but here we're a concealed handgun state. And pretty much like the movies, you never know who's going to have a gun. I know 60, 70-year-old grandmothers who are walking around with a 38 in their purse every day. So where
you're
does
in Texas,
it become
though,
a situation?
Right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Have you ever treated a patient and had something fall out of their pocket?
Yeah. We've picked up I talk about the little grandmother. We picked up a little gentleman, probably 4 or 5 weeks ago. And as he's getting ready, he walks out to the ambulance, and as he's getting ready to sit down on the stretcher, he reaches behind his back, pulls out a 9mm pistol, and sets it on the workstation. he was nice enough to do that. Yeah, and it's exactly what it was. It was like, hey, hang on, I've got this. But I have in the past found weapons on patients where, you know, they didn't declare them or didn't tell us they had them. And that's a little bit hairy, but you know, and that's one of those situations where, unfortunately, you know, past history and everything else, you can't sit there and go, well, I'm not going to walk into this house because they might be a problem, or this person looks like a problem, because you never know now, especially here. You spend $300 and 8 hours on a Saturday, and it's legal for you to carry a handgun. So that's, you know, Texas has a lot of opponents and proponents of the concealed handgun law, but that's where, on our side of it, it does get a little bit dicey.
Now, you guys think that
if
you guys did it with a handgun, if we were allowed to carry handguns, that it would be a deterrent for something like that? Or do you just think it would just make us look more like the enemy to people who would maybe not otherwise, you know, pull something on us? Because we're not the police. We're not somebody that's, you know.
That's a good point.
I think handguns would only have made things worse.
Well, how often do we have to explain to people that, no, we're not police officers? I don't know how many times I have children come up to me. Are you a cop? Are you a cop? No, I'm not. I'm not a police officer, especially if you go to some places where there's been trouble in the past and people don't want to talk to us because we wear similar uniforms to the police and everything else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's a great point. City I used to work in down in Central Texas, we wore the exact same uniform as Waco, as the police department in the city, down to the patches. I mean, even they, you know, our state patches here looked very similar to their police department insignia. So at that point, you know, it was dangerous to be a police officer in that city, and I didn't particularly want to go into a situation looking any more like them than we had to. So, you know, where do you draw that line? Because just because we're putting a gun on us doesn't mean you're not going to become a victim.
Yeah. I think I've seen some of the comments in the posts and talk about how, well, we shouldn't, if we do carry them, it should be concealed. We shouldn't be, so that'll eliminate that issue. if as long as we conceal it, it'll eliminate the issue.
I think that we have
that only depends on how well it's concealed.
Yeah, I don't think I conceal it pretty good. It'd be very it's as uncomfortable as the vest trying to hide it.
Absolutely.
And well, I mean, beyond that, I'm sorry, man. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. If you look at most of the concealed hardware on the market, the holsters and stuff, they're fit to be put. They're supposed to be put underneath your shirt. How many of us in our uniform policies have to wear shirts tucked in, look clean, pressed, whatever?
Right.
It's going to be very hard to hide a firearm.
Well, even beyond that,
there will be a market.
Yeah.
There'll be a market for the FUPA holster.
Yeah, but
once
a group starts doing something, it's not a secret. I mean, you know, once you start carrying a firearm, you know, the general folks that we deal with, you know, how often the majority of our patients are people, I would say, in most systems that are fairly wise to the system. And I'd say the majority of certainly we deal with a large amount of people who that's the first time that they've ever been in an ambulance. But for every one of those statements where, this is the first time I've ever been in an ambulance, I'll get five people who know the system and know what to do or know what to say or are, you know, somehow familiar with ambulances in the system. So those 5 to 1 are going to know that we're carrying.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if carrying a defensive weapon versus an offensive weapon would make that difference. Would be a difference in there?
I don't think so.
Yeah,
there are a lot of people who seem to think that the taser is a lethal weapon, and they've seen cases of the police or other people using the taser as a way to inflict punishment. And they will associate the taser, even though it should be a defensive weapon, with the worst use of it that they have seen. I mean, that's the way we are. You hear about Toyotas accelerating. We assume that all Toyotas accelerate. And now they're finding out that
Toyotas burst in flames.
There was no cause.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we associate anything with the worst case rather than trying to look for balanced information on it. And the taser, I think if we were to carry it, we should only use the one that is requires contact in the hand with the patient so that we're not standing back and tasing from a distance. Police can do that. If we need that done, we should have police there, but that would restrict us to using it much less as an offensive weapon and only as a last ditch, because if you've got to wait for the person to get close to you and they see it and they don't get close to you, mission accomplished. But it also keeps the person who's got an itchy trigger finger from seeing somebody move toward them and just discharging it rather than saying, stop or I'll shoot.
Yeah.
And just with a taser. I mean, not with a real gun. You know, what do they do with the real gun?
Great point. Hey, guys, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to cut out. We're getting phoned out at our station.
All right, Randy. Thanks for calling in, buddy.
Thanks for joining us.
So, Tim, you know, we talked about firearms. We talked about knives. You mentioned tasers. What about if we just step it back and just say, you know, give EMS a baton?
I don't think a baton is a good idea. We have a clipboard. If you need to hit somebody with something, the clipboard is there, whether it's plastic or metal, and it's not something that is really convenient to hit somebody with. If you need to hit somebody, you probably only need to hit them once. And if you're doing it more than that, it's because it's designed to be used repeatedly as a weapon. Clipboards are not designed that way. They're awkward to use as a weapon. They're mainly defensive.
Yeah, tough books. The tough books are good.
Tough books are good.
Yeah. Same idea. And your employer is not going to want to pay for the damage of being smashed on the patient's head.
Yeah.
You know, one of the consensuses that was reached is the best weapon we have is our brains. And not that we're going to go bash somebody with those, but we're going to use them not to get into these situations or more importantly, get out of them. And I think that when you start, and that's why I threw the baton out there or a knife or anything else, when you start talking about using something to battle somebody with, you have to be trained in hand-to-hand combat. And that's one thing that we just haven't discussed. I mean, how many people out there are actually, unless they're taking karate or judo or one of these martial arts in a recreational setting, how many people are really trained to be able to defend themselves? So we really have to think back, you know, step back even a step further and just say, you know, you got to step away from this situation.
And even if they are trained in it, how effective is it going to be in, you know, somebody's apartment? Going into the projects, apartments are usually not roomy. And yeah. You may have several people in different parts of the room, so you've got no free space to stand back and set up a kick or whatever you want to do. The kind of fighting that people do with martial arts training is usually one-on-one. It's only when they get to the advanced belts that they usually let them spar two-on-one or three-on-one and stuff like that. And that's more realistic for what we're doing. But still, it's usually in a ring or an open floor where you don't have a bunch of obstacles around. You step back and you trip over your gear. All of a sudden, you're on the floor, and you've got two or three people on top of you, or maybe they're throwing chairs at you and other things that you don't ordinarily think of as weapons. It's not good to think of this as something offensive. You know, the movie Monty Python has the best scene. It's just a bunny. Okay, run away, run away, run away, run away.
Yeah. You know, one thing I will say,
we can
go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, we can always run away and call for help. And if we're not able to run away because of what, you know, maybe they have a gun, maybe they have a knife, then we need to talk our way out of it. I've had a gun pulled on me in the patient's house, and you know, I just stopped right there and said, "Okay, what do you want us to do?" He said, "I want you to leave." Like, okay, we're leaving.
Bye. Yeah. See ya.
I don't need to argue. Yeah, it wasn't something where I could predict that this was going to happen. There was nothing we knew about the call. We got no information from dispatch that there had been any reports of violence. And when we talked with the police afterward, he said, "We don't know anything about what caused it to happen this time, but there was no history with that address. It was in a good part of town. And if I had a gun and I start thinking, okay, he's got a gun out, I need to be prepared to defend myself, to return fire, stuff like that, I'm thinking the wrong thing. My only thought should be I need to get my partner and myself out the door. It's nice if I can bring the gear with me.
Right,
I haven't
exactly.
put it down yet, so there was no reason to worry about that. But, you know, just back off, make yourself less of a threat to the person. They perceive us as threats as much as any of us perceive them as threats. So we need to work at de-escalating the situation. Okay, I'm not a threat to you. If you want me to leave, I'll leave. Get the police, come back with the police, have the police talk with them. The police will do it in whatever numbers are appropriate. And then you figure out, is there a patient? Is it a misunderstanding? What's going on? But we don't need to be figuring out, what weapon do I use? It's not like a video game where it's like, a choose weapon number three.
So, Tim, I'm yeah, right. You know, click on the lower button and choose your submachine gun. Do you carry a
no,
knife?
The chainsaw.
Do you carry anything?
Yeah. I carry a pen. And sometimes I carry a clipboard, but I'm not a fan of carrying clipboards I like to get the information.
So you don't even carry a knife for utility purposes?
No.
How about you?
I have a knife in the OB kit if I need it.
Well, that's a scalpel.
Yes, but that's a knife.
And then you got to repack that OB kit, and it's usually pre-sealed, and then you got to explain to somebody why you
pulled it. Then we get to the cost factor again.
Right.
So yeah, that's like $60.
Yeah, exactly. No, I don't carry anything. I have no. I never carried a knife or anything like that on my person. Like I said, maybe I'm a little bit of a Nancy, but you know, I try to think about everything I'm doing and maintaining my awareness on scenes. And of course, now next time I go to work, I'll probably get into a fight with somebody because I'm jinxing myself here. But you know, I've never really had anything like that. And issues like that, and I think you guys both mentioned too about this, about having that situational awareness and being aware. And like you said, Tim, you know, getting out of there if you have that if you find yourself in that situation. I think a lot of people get a lot of the argument of, well, we should have a weapon or whatever is because I can't get out of there with all my equipment and everything. Leave the equipment there. If you find yourself in that situation,
yes,
where you leave it there. You can go back and get it. It can be replaced. You can't, your partner can't, you know, and again, make yourself not feel as if you're a threat to that person. I want to mention that there's a website out there. It's DT4EMS.com. It's defensive training, defensive tactics for EMS, and they have a lot of cool videos on the site that are free to watch and kind of give you a little bit of, like you mentioned, you know, being with a patient, and the patient will lunge at you or something like that, and they kind of give some tips and some ways you can try to, you know, get to a safe environment. Their whole thing is escaping, you know, getting escape skills, not necessarily being confrontational with the patient. It's all about getting away and letting the police come and handle it.
You know, I'm so glad that you actually
started. It's not
about
winning the argument.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
And I'm really glad, Jim, you went down that path, because that's really what it's about. It's, you know, if we're not formally trained in those things, instead of looking up, you know, YouTube videos on how to have a knife fight or fantasizing about carrying a weapon, the more practical approach is learning these skills, you know. And it reminds me back in the days of, you know, when I was a young man and I had a girlfriend tell me about mugger's money. I never even knew what mugger's money was. And it's basically, if you're walking down the street, you have a couple of dollars in your pocket, and if somebody's trying to mug you, you basically take it out, you throw it on the ground, and you run away. They're going to stop and try to pick up the money before they chase you. And
yeah,
what Jim was saying before is absolutely leave your equipment. You know, we're all trained. Our safety comes first. And as a matter of fact, in the chat room, someone was saying that too. Our safety comes first. And we've gone so far past that of, no, we've got to do something harmful to that other person. How about nothing and get away? You know, sorry.
Well, we're afraid
that
somebody else is going to get away with something. And it's
right,
part of human nature to feel that way. But we're supposed to be smart enough to overcome our, you know, instinctual responses. And if we're not, maybe we shouldn't be in EMS.
Yeah, no, you made it's a good point. We're not here to win arguments. You know, we have a job to do, and I guess, like you said, human nature is to not let somebody get away with something. But, you know, in the end, you can wind up getting seriously hurt in the process, or getting yourself in bigger trouble than you need to be in because you did something that was outside your training and what your job is supposed to be. Listen, guys, I'm going to end it there. We only have about maybe 5 minutes left. I encourage people to go check out Tim's blog and read his article in the comments there. At roguemedic.com, and also, again, check out that DT4EMS.com site as well. I had a whole list of topics to get through tonight, but we got a little passionate about this arming our EMS, so that's all right, that's fine. Two posts I want to mention. Bob Sullivan has a blog, EMSPatientsPerspective.com, and he has something on there about giving EMS a federal home. And we talked about this on this show as well. And just very simple thing you can do to kind of get involved in kind of getting EMS more on a federal level. And there's a little copy and paste type thing there that you can go ahead and easy to do to go ahead and maybe take some action and maybe get EMS more recognized on the federal level. The other thing I want to mention too is,
and that's a cut and paste template, exactly, guys. So you know that's something we can do.
Yeah, and
use of power.
And also, if you're a member of the NAEMT, they actually have it there as well, along with all the congressional information that you can just go ahead and sign up there, and they have everything already set up for you there. You don't have to even, you don't even have to go up look up your congressional leader. You can just go ahead and do that. The other thing I want to mention too is Rescuing Providence had a post on the National EMS Museum, and I was actually surprised, really. Well, I shouldn't be too surprised, but I was a little surprised to see that not that many people that were commenting on their post there even knew there was a National EMS Museum. And right now it's virtual, it's just online. They're trying to get funds to make a physical museum. And actually, a guy I knew from New York City that moved out of the city, I believe he's in North Carolina now. He's in charge of the virtual archives there, Mark Peck, and pretty good site there. They got some pretty interesting things on the website there. I'm going to put a link as well for that, but just try to maybe get involved in that a little bit. If you know, they have stuff on the website, at the museum's website, on how you can get involved. If you have old equipment or stuff like that, maybe that you know of, you can maybe get over to them and figure a way to get it to them to kind of build that museum up. And my favorite part about that post is somebody who said that if you look at the logo for the National EMS Museum, it's missing something, and that's a fire truck. There's no fire truck in the logo. So that was pretty cool comment that somebody made there. So, and that's pretty much it. The other stuff, the frequent flyer and the small talk that I want to mention tonight, I'll put the links up on the blog post. You can go read the articles by Tom Dick and over at EMS1 on the frequent flyer case study that was done there. I encourage you to go do that. We'll probably bring it up on a future episode or two down the road. And that's pretty much it. Tim, thanks again, of course, for joining us. I really appreciate it. Always great insight from you.
Thanks for having me.
And, of course, everybody can find you over at roguemedic.com. And you plan on being in Baltimore this year, Tim?
I don't know if I'm going to the exhibit hall or if I'm just going to do the podcasting. Chris Montero says he's looking at getting a suite and doing podcasting offsite. For some reason, EMS today is not giving them floor space.
Yeah, I
heard about
that.
But if you go and you're at the exhibit hall, you should go to the EMS Museum exhibit. Kelly Grayson's usually there. Too old to work, too young to retire is often there. It's a great exhibit. They have a lot of the old stuff that is from before I was involved in EMS, and a lot of interesting stuff, a lot of interesting history, and people who are familiar with the history to explain to you what some of the stuff is, what the Dali suction catheter is, and why we don't use it anymore.
Right. Yeah, but excellent site. And again, that should be. I think people should take advantage of that if they go to Baltimore. I'm going to try to make it. I'm hoping I'm going to be there at least for the exhibit this year. If not, I'll probably try. I'm sure I'll make the one up coming up at the end of the year at the expo, one way or the other. So, one thing at a time.
Maybe we'll take a trip down Saturday, Jim.
Yeah, exactly. All right, guys, have a great night.
Well, unfortunately, I will only be there Thursday and Friday.
Right.
I'm sure.
You know, I just want to say, Jim, I know you want to close this up, but on my Facebook page, on the Want New Facebook fan page, we've already gotten a half a dozen comments on this blog, on this radio blog.
Oh, yeah.
And they're still out there, still very much for arming of EMS.
Cool. Unbelievable. All right, guys, let me end it there. We got about maybe 30 seconds, so I don't want to hit the wall here. So, everyone in the chat room, thanks for calling, thanks for posting and making comments and joining us. If you're listening live, of course, thank you for listening live as well. Guys, until next week, as always, Jim Hoffman from EMS Office Hours. Stay safe.